This is Frank Curry, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 9th of January 2013. Frank Curry, Part 1.
Frank Curry, Preston, Lancashire, 31st of May 1943.
Would you say your father was an educated man?
He went to a grammar school and he was an army officer.
Did he rise in the ranks?
He became an army officer because he had a grammar school education. Okay, that was the custom in those days at the beginning of the war.
Did the army run in the family then?
Yes. His father was a lieutenant colonel.
Mm. And what was your father's first name?
Leslie.
And did he rise to anything in significance?
No, he rose to major, which is not really very far. But he had a good career.
Yeah. So did that kind of set a precedent for you as well? Were you thinking about going into the forces or expected to go into the forces?
No, there was no pressure of that sort. I did think about it a lot. But in the end, the thing I think that decided me was that I wanted to go to university, which in the early 60s, if you were in a grammar school sixth form, wasn't necessarily the automatic choice it is today. You know, it was only about, 5% of people went to university in those days, and most of my colleagues in the sixth form, as I did, went immediately into jobs. I went into the Ministry of Defence at the sort of executive officer level, and then after a year and a half, decided that I would like to go to university. So that sort of steered me away from an army career, really.
Were you the first Curry to go to university?
Yes.
Breaking the ground.
Yeah, that's the way things were in those days.
So where did he go and what did he read?
I went to University of London on my headmaster's recommendation to the School of Oriental and African Studies to read history. But in those days, London was very much a federal university, so I did European and English history-based at Queen Mary College and some lectures at UCL and LSE. That was the way it was. And then specialised in African topics for the remainder of the degree.
They did really well on University Challenge, didn't they? Did you see them?
Yes, I did, yes. So S was a good place to be.
What drew you, do you think, towards history as an interest?
Well, because it was the subject I enjoyed it at, in the sixth form, simple as that, really. And still remains with me today. I spend a lot of time reading history, and it stood me in good stead.
So did you spend any length of time in Africa having...
Yes, we did. In the second year, we did two terms at the University of Ghana on a sort of an exchange scheme. So we went out by boat, on a banana boat to Ghana. So I spent two terms there, spring and summer terms in 1965, I think it was, when Kwame Nkrumah was the president. And then spent, after the terms were over, we spent some time travelling. I was with a colleague on doing the same course. We went by boat to Nigeria and then travelled around Nigeria just before the Civil War. And then down to Bangui in the Central African Republic, currently of interest. And then eventually ended up at in the Congo, down the Congo River in Brazzaville. And came back from there.
So as your university course came to a close, what was your plan of action? What was your life plan?
I still had the right to go back to the Ministry of Defence because I was effective. They gave me leave of absence, which was very good. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know what to do, but unexpectedly I got a first-class degree, which I regret very much. Funnily enough, because it encouraged me, and my professor encouraged me to think that research was a good way to go. So I did a sort of an extended MA, MPhil type course, but I realised that I was not cut out for research at the end of that, so decided to return to the ministry in a quite different sort of entry point branch of work, really.
Doing, may I ask you what you were doing?
Yes, I had an when I asked to go back to the ministry, I had an interview by an officer from the Royal Naval Supply and Transport Service, which in those days, I mean, it dates its history back to Samuel Pepys, actually. They ran all the... there was a completely civilian organisation, but they ran all the logistics for the Navy, essentially, notably the RFA fleet, which is about probably 40 ships in those days, all the ammunition, fuel, supplies for the Navy. It was a huge organisation, and, it was a practical sort of thing which appealed to me.
But you were a civilian, I presume, were you?
Yes, it is a civilian organisation, but in a wartime situation, as happened in the Second World War, you were immediately put into reserve officer uniforms. It was a sort of, you know, something that dated back in history, really.
So did that happen to you in 82 when the Falklands War broke out?
No, funnily enough, they didn't do that, although many of my colleagues went down on the ammunition ships and tankers, for example. A lot of guys went down on the Atlantic Conveyor, for example, which sunk. Yeah, absolutely. But I don't think they put them into... because it was never officially declared a war, if you remember.
It was a conflict, wasn't it?
It was a conflict, yes. Yeah, indeed.
So did you have... and again, I appreciate you may not be able to answer this fully... did you have any particular role or relationship in the Falklands War, with the war?
Yes. At the time, I think I pointed it out on my sort of outline CV, I was in charge of all the fuel depots in Scotland. I was based at on the Gaerloch, near the part of the Clyde submarine base. Because my previous post had been working for Commander-in-Chief Fleet, where a lot of the job was fuel planning, I was asked to come down to London to take part in all the logistic fuel planning, really, which you know, underpinned the entire operation. To be quite honest, it was a long, it was a very big logistic exercise.
Sure. To get the fuel south.
Oh, absolutely, and the right sort of fuel, because the carriers at the time, Hermes in particular. Was burning black oil, and so there was quite a lot of complications of getting the mix right and the aviation fuel as well. I won't go into the details of it all, but it was quite a complicated exercise. And of course chartering ships to back up the RFAs. The RFAs remained down there the whole time, but there was a long chain of supplies going down. There was airdrop and so on and so forth.
The RFA is
Royal Fleet Auxiliary.
Okay.
You've probably seen them on television programmes. They replenish ships at sea. I spent 2 years on one, in my initial, when I initially joined. We all had some involvement in the Falklands War if we were working for the Navy, for sure.
One of the complications is knowing how long it's going to go on for. Nobody knew, really. Everybody assumed it'd be over by the end of April, but nobody quite knew how long the Falklands problem would persist.
I can't really comment on that, to be honest. We were so busy at the time just getting on with the job, thinking about the big picture was not something I particularly... It was a very exciting time, and the whole machine worked very well.
Were you aware of any contact between the Ministry of Defence and British Antarctic Survey at that time? Because
absolutely not. I really had no... real knowledge of the British Antarctic Survey. I mean, like most members of the public, my only thoughts about the Antarctic were... I was at school, of course, during the Transantarctic Expedition by Vivian Fuchs and so on.
You were following it?
Oh, yes. It was very interesting. But that was probably about it.
Did it capture your imagination particularly?
At the time, as a schoolboy, yes. But it was not something that... dominated my thinking, really.
You hadn't suggested to yourself that one day you might like to go down there?
No.
In person?
Absolutely not, no. Yeah. No.
So what made you look at British Antarctic Survey as a career move? Was it to escape or because there was a better job coming up? What was the reasoning?
Well, it was quite simple, really. At the time, I was detached for 2 years... to the Joint Services College at Greenwich, which is an extremely interesting job. I was on the directing staff. The Cold War was just ending. In fact, the course was in Berlin on the night the wall came down. And we were all, sort of so wrapped up in the Cold War in MOD in those days. And at when the Soviet Union collapsed and so on and so forth, we were asked by MOD to do quite a lot of thinking about the role the military would play in a post Cold War world, and it was quite clear that that there would have to be a peace dividend and reduction of financial underpinning for the armed services, contraction and so on. And the sort of roles we were looking for were the sort of roles that actually turned out to be the case, particularly Yugoslavia, the collapse there. We did a lot of work on that. And thinking about, supporting UN operations and so on and so forth. So it all seemed a bit, after the excitement of the Cold War, it all seemed a bit,
routine,
less interesting, yeah. And I simply saw this advertisement. in those days, government departments used to circulate, quangos like the BAS used to circulate things round, and it seemed to me the sort of person they were looking for they couldn't promote. I mean, I discovered this subsequently. They couldn't find somebody internally to fill that sort of role. The other influence on me was my boss at the time at the Defence College, who's a naval captain called Pat McLaren, had previously been captain of HMS Endurance. And when I mentioned my interest in this post, he then took a sort of great interest in it, and he knew David Drury. So I sort of went to the interview with a good sort of backing, really, from Pat. And it's as simple as that, really. The MOD actually said, we'll loan you for 3 years. David Drury sort of said that wasn't very acceptable, but the mod told me confidentially if I wanted to come back, there was no problem, really.
So who was paying you then?
Oh, no, the survey was paying me. It was a full transfer. But I knew that if I wanted to go back to MOD within about 3 or 4 years, I could do so.
You weren't burning your bridges?
Not entirely, no. I'm quite a cautious person, actually. and it seemed very exciting, prospect at the time.
What was so exciting about it? Because it's unusual. At that time, it was unusual for BAS to appoint people from outside. So you were you were one of the earliest incomers, shall we say.
Yes, that's probably true, actually. David Blake being another one.
What was attracting you to it?
Well, I think need for a change. I mean, I was used to moving jobs quite frequently anyway in the MOD and moving location and so forth. So it wasn't a big sort of move in that sense. I was quite used to moving around and doing odd things. And I guess Pat, really, he had a big influence on me at the time. He became, as you probably know, chairman of the Antarctic Heritage Trust, and he was a close friend of mine. He inspired me, I suppose you could say.
Yeah. Fids tell good tales, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. But I mean, I had misgivings about it because the job at Greenwich was extremely interesting. I mean, it was on a different level, really. It was an 8-month course set up originally by Montgomery, to get the services working together. But it had a big scope, so I knew I was going into a much smaller organisation, but nevertheless, one makes decisions in life, and I didn't mind moving around.
So if you had a line, one end was the attraction of BAS, the other end was wanting to leave the ministry. Whereabouts on that line was your decision taken? Half 50-50?
Yes, probably. I mean, I think I had one more course to do at Greenwich, and then I would be posted somewhere else. And I suspected that might not be such an interesting sort of prospect. you know, one never knows.
So it was a calculated gamble.
Well, I don't know about the calculation in it, but it was a decision I took. Yeah.
What did you make of that? Well, first of all, tell me about the interview. Do you remember much about the interview? Who interviewed you? And
yes,
how grilling it was.
David chaired it. Barry Haywood was on the panel. No, he didn't chair it. No, sorry, the Chief Personnel Officer of NERC chaired it. And here again, I must confess to sort of a bit of inside influence in that David Griffiths, who was Chief Personnel Officer of NERC at the time, had come from the same background as myself. He'd been in the Royal Naval Supply and Transport Service. And I knew him, not terribly well, but I knew him and he knew of me. And I guess that probably had an influence. Mm. Yeah.
So much so that, was it a foregone conclusion?
No. I didn't think about it in that way. I mean, I felt with Pat's backing, I stood a reasonable chance. But there were some other good people that they interviewed that I knew as well. So, you know, I think they sorted out some good choices. It was one of those things. You know, one goes for interviews. I'm sure you've done the same. And you don't know what the outcome's going to be.
Do you remember them bowling you any googlies, any difficult questions? What sort of things did they ask about?
Well, they asked about what I'd been doing. They asked me quite a lot of questions about long-distance logistics and so forth. I don't think any of the questions that they asked me, I couldn't, floored me exactly. Hmm. But my memory of them, I'm afraid, is...
And what do you feel you took with you from your previous career, which was particularly useful in the new role?
Well, I think two things mainly. One was obviously long-distance logistics, because I was very much involved in that when I was fleet logistics officer. I had 35 ships to programme all over the world. It was that sort of background that, as I suspected, on a smaller scale, was relevant to the surveys mission. So that was that. The other side... was knowledge of Whitehall, negotiating in Whitehall, the money side, really, and that sort of thing, which, I think I was well qualified in. I'd managed a very big programme prior to my Greenwich appointment. I was Assistant Director of Navy Works, which sounds a bit prosaic, but actually was an enormous programme. I had a programme of billions, really. At the time, we were putting Trident in, and the NATO decision to increase defence spending, which was agreed between Callaghan and Schmidt back in 78. Mm. So we were getting 3% increases each year, which is enormous in defence terms. Mm. Putting in all the Trident stuff, you know, it was all big stuff, you know, really. And I had to write a lot of the cases, you know, that went to ministers and so forth, to the Treasury and make presentations and that sort of thing, you know. So I was...
I would think that was a major playing card, wasn't it, for you in your...
I don't think I made too much of it at the interview, but thinking back afterwards, you asked me the question what I thought I brought to... In retrospect, I think that was probably quite important.
The Joker.
Yeah.
In Chisholm Frontier.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
So was there an element then of perhaps... Would they perhaps see an element of... gamekeeper turned poacher, in that because you knew the inner workings of Whitehall, mm-hmm. you were therefore quite well placed to actually apply to it for funding for Baskers.
Yeah. I realised subsequently that the whole Whitehall scene and the relationships between NERC, BAS, the Foreign Office, the Department of Education, as it was in those days, Education and Science, was the ministry which funded NERC. All that sort of thing and the difficulties they'd had in the late 80s, with that, the funding for the additional infrastructure that had been agreed by Mrs. Thatcher, all that sort of thing. I mean, I only became cognizant of that after I joined, of course, and read the papers and discussed it and so on and so forth. But I realised that must have been in the back of their minds when they were interviewing me. Yeah.
The 80s was, well, the Middle Ages was a huge expansion time for Bass because of the post-Falkland funding. I think the famous line from Mrs. Thatcher was, it's cheaper to give Bass some money than build a new battleship, or I paraphrase, perhaps, or even misquote, but still.
Yes, so sounds very plausible.
What was the state of Bass when you arrived then? Was it, I mean, you were moving into a smaller organisation, which much smaller budgets, much tighter controls required because there was no leeway. How was Bass when you got there?
Well, they were riding the crest of a wave, really, was the impression I got. You know, they'd had the great, enormous fillip of the ozone hole discovery. And I realised a lot later how important that was to them, because if you actually look back at sort of NERC reports and so on, back in the 70s and so on, you began to realise that scientifically Bass was really not a big player. And some of the research was probably a bit prosaic. Not that I'm in a position to judge it, but I got that impression. So I think the ozone layer tended to put them, in the big league. Mm. So they were very, chipper about that. And then, of course, on the logistics and administrative side, the new infrastructure that was going in, you know, was very exciting to them. And so forth. So there was certainly my predecessor, John Borden, and all the people that I met, David Drury. They were full of optimism. It was a good time to join, I felt. Yeah.
Was John Borden a difficult act to follow? Because he'd been there for 40 years?
No, I'm not sure about 40 years.
30, perhaps?
No, not as much as that, okay. I don't think. Yes, he originally started his career as a civil servant, I think, in Department of Nature Conservancy or something, quite a sort of prosaic area, and came into the survey, I think, I don't know, back in the 70s, I think. Or,
right.
I'm not absolutely sure. You'd have to check with Joanna.
But he was your predecessor?
Oh, yes. As soon as I joined at Christmas 1990, and we both went down on New Year's Eve, actually, down to the Falklands and did a tour of Antarctica and came back on the Bransfield. So we had a lot of opportunity to discuss things. And David was with us at the time. And then, as you probably know, we were due to leave from Halley in January, late January, early February 1991. The Bransfield had lost a motor, within, I think, 24 hours, we realised that we were stuck in the ice. And at that stage, David and John felt that their place was really back at base, and that there was only room on the Twin Otter there was one Twin Otter left. at Halley, I got a picture of them leaving, so they flew back to Rotherham and then came out on the I forget how they came out now. I think they came out on Twin Otters to Punta Arenas. I'm not absolutely sure.
Leaving you behind.
Leaving me behind on the ship with Stuart Lawrence, who you doubtless met, a large team of builders that had been building the then new Halley, you see, the one on the stilts. And we were stuck for a long time, I think 6 weeks, maybe two months or whatever. I mean, there was certainly, because the ship lacked one motor, and the sea ice was particularly bad at that time of the year, you know, we'd actually sort of mentally, I think, you know, felt that we would probably be stuck there for the winter, really. I mean, everything's uncertain in the Antarctic, you know, but I was completely new to all this, so it was a question of, you know, sort of keeping everybody reasonably happy on board, because the building team had been working extremely hard, and, you know, building workers don't like to be, you know, stuck in their cabins all that time. There was all morale issues, really. Anyway, we did get out, and there we are. And so I then came back,
tell me a bit more about that. What a baptism of ice. You've only been with the organisation a short time.
Yeah.
Already the Antarctic was teaching you.
Yeah. Well, somebody used that term, actually. Must have been quite pressing. Andy Clark, I think, when I got back, a bit of a baptism of fire sort of thing. But yes, it was a very useful experience. Once we had got out of the ice, the ship lost power off the South Orkneys completely. Some generators went, and that wasn't a comfortable time, you know, to be spending the whole night beam on to the sea, you know, with no power. That was so, you know, it certainly impressed upon me, you know, the hazards of working in the Antarctic and the fact that there was no rescue services or anything like that really to speak of. Other national operators, if they were around, but there weren't any around at the time. So, absolutely.
Ironically, it sounds like a perfect introduction to the Antarctic, because having gone through all that yourself, you, back in Cambridge, in your comfy chair, you would have had a much clearer idea of what your staff are going through and the risks they were taking.
Yes, absolutely. It was as things worked out. It was a good experience thinking back. Yes.
What was done then in that crisis to try and maintain morale? Was there? Did Stuart Horace have a few tricks of his sleeve, or did you get out your concertina? Or
well, it was then I realised that I was in a sort of different culture. Really, when David was on board, I think they must have been on board. I don't know. Maybe as much as 2 or 3 days, something like that, before the decision was taken to return to Halley and then for them to transfer out. The culture change was that it was a sort of expeditionary culture. So I was used to a very much authoritarian regime in the Navy. You know, if you're on a naval ship or whatever, you get constant broadcast telling you what's going on, and you know, you were left in no doubt the command was in charge. I mean, when I was fleet logistics officer, if I sent a signal to the ship in the name of the commander in chief, the orders were carried out. There was no, you know, the commander in chief would be behind you. But in the survey, David used to conduct these meetings at sort of 12 o'clock, and everybody would come along and they would all talk about it.
Was that an outbreak of democracy?
Well, yes. So, and this was, yeah, that was probably the biggest culture shock I had, really. And I think Stuart and I were sort of then, sort of, you know, after they left, we were sort of bound to try and do something on the same lines, not quite as dramatic as that. That was certainly interesting.
Can you elaborate a bit on that? What happened after David had gone?
David and John, yeah. And one or two other people I think went with him who, you know, had a hard season, which was fair enough.
What was the daily routine, or what sort of things did you do to maintain morale?
Well, we got a sports programme going. One of the fortunate things was that one of the hulls of the ship was completely clear at that stage because they supplied Halley and so on and so forth. So we were able to rig up a badminton net, and I think I enjoyed that more than anything, really. I'm trying to get, you know, some of the builders interested, some of the staff on board to come and play badminton. That's all you can do, really. They had a good, you know, reasonably good library on the ship. There were videos. But there was quite a lot of drinking done, particularly by the building workers, who were on contract, of course, on a short-term contract. I think they found it, because they'd had a very hard season, putting that, you know, and were looking forward to getting home, and then suddenly they realised they weren't going to see, you know, might not be able to see their, you know, relatives and so forth for a long period of time.
Did you have anybody at home that would be missing you?
Well, Sue, you mean?
She
were still living here, actually. She's used to me being. I spent most 35 years living away from home, one sort or another, with the MOD constantly. You know, when I was up in Scotland, I, you know, was on my own up there, and so she was quite used to me being away, and we were able to send faxes. I gave a letter for David to carry back to. Tell Sue, you know, what I was going. So, the survey are very good with, you know, the personnel staff are very good about keeping relatives informed about what was going on. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
One of the recurrent themes in these interviews is certainly in that era, was the autonomy that the bases felt they had from London, in that because communications were so distant and so fragile.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
Actually, you had to make your own minds up.
Yeah.
You couldn't rely upon somebody in Cambridge sending you a fax. So that culture of making decisions corporately on the spot with a leader,
yes,
was already endemic, I think.
It was, yes, and very good and very appropriate, really, I felt. I mean, you know, Cambridge had to run operations and so on, but and coordinate things. I think the problems came, in my view, when, you know, we had the internet and all, email,
yeah,
came in. I was very sceptical about introducing that.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's part of modern life. You can't oppose it and so forth. But my experience in the Navy was that there was an enormous premium put on sending very clear messages of what had to be done or whatever. And we were very limited on words. It was all HF transmission and still is in the Navy. And because of the security involved, and you know, all your signals were looked at by the commander-in-chief every day. So you had to, there was enormous premium on getting it right, you know, that the captains of ships understood, so on and so forth. When you start with email, it's a horror show. It's just...
How do you mean, then?
Well, because...
You mean liberalisation is a horror?
no, I mean, you lose all discipline, really. People, you know... just express what they're thinking. Half of the email is probably about personal matters and not work and so on and so forth. I think that, you know, it's one of the things I regretted most. I think in the old days, as you say, the base commanders, I had a lot of autonomy and that worked pretty well. But once you start, you know, allowing staff to send messages from all over the place, rumours start. I mean, I can give you a concrete example. Once email had started, you know, we had a ship stuck in the ice, which is fairly regular sort of thing that happened. Messages would go back to the relatives. The relatives would get in touch with local newspapers, and you'd have the Grimsby Herald or the Manchester Evening News ringing you up saying, it's dire. Well, rather like, you know, this thing we've had over Christmas, New Year. You get all that. It becomes terribly confused. Coming from the military background, I don't like that. But it's no good fighting the computer people.
There are some FIDs who also agree, modern-day FIDs who would agree with that, who don't want their wife to tell them that the boiler's broken down when they're the other side of the planet. Normally, wife was sorted out.
Yeah.
Instead of which they tell their husband who can do nothing about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's another example, isn't it?
Okay. So anyway, eventually you were released from the ICE and back at Cambridge, back behind your desk. To get on with the job in hand.
Yeah.
And you were there for nearly 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were the first things you had to address?
Right. Well, the first thing was the money side of life, really. When David and I were travelling down, we talked about the future. And the survey at that time, as you know, had acquired additional twin otters. It was going to be... introducing the James Clark Ross, which was a much larger ship than the John Biscoe it was replacing, introducing the Dash 7 aircraft, gravel runway at Rothera, a new unknown type of structure at Halley, and all the ideas he had for scientific programmes and so on and so forth. So it was very, very clear... to me, and he asked me to get on with it, really, was putting a submission together, really. And, well, first of all, doing some rigorous estimating of all this. I mean, I think the survey had done tremendously well in the procurement side of life and getting Halley set up and the gravel runway, I think, you know, and the James Clark Ross and so on and so forth. But what perhaps they weren't so used to was actually looking at what future running costs might be of this larger infrastructure, because, you know, government's very good at handing out capital grants, but they never give you the running costs. So the most important thing was doing that job and then going up to Whitehall. You've heard of the Badger Review Group and so on, and getting getting stuff started on that, and that quite startled the Department of Education, you know, because they'd gone through this very embarrassing business of the, you know, the money not getting through to Baz. You know all about that.
No.
Oh, right.
In a nutshell, what happened?
Well, it was before my time, but I have all the had all the papers and knew all about it. What had happened was that after the Falklands War, as you rightly said, the then director Dick Laws was summoned to Downing Street and asked what he what he wanted, and all the things that I've just described. Dick had identified, you know, greater accessibility into Antarctica and so on and so forth. The capital sums had been approved, but what had happened was that the money, NERC had somehow obstructed the money getting through in a timely fashion. As a result, the programme was not proceeding at the speed that it had been originally envisaged. And matters came to a head. I'm not quite sure what precipitated the thing, but it got to the ears of Mrs. Thatcher, who sent one of these handbag letters to Baker at the time, who was the Minister for Education and Science, what is going on here? So they appointed a committee of inquiry, chaired by a senior diplomat from the Foreign Office, to inquire into this, which was, in Whitehall terms, extremely embarrassing. Mm. And NERC had their knuckles wrapped over it. And the Department of Education and Science were also extremely embarrassed over it. So that when I came in and we had these early meetings, it was under that sort of shadow, you see. And
so the shit had hit the fan before you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But what they weren't prepared for was another bid for enhanced running costs. So, I think it was only a week after I got back from Antarctica, that I was plunged into these discussions, you see. And I remember the senior civil servant at the time said, "My God, you want a PES bid? You understand what a PES bid is, do you know?" The terminology has changed nowadays, but the whole public expenditure round. And if you make a bid, you know, it's a PES bid and you're for more money and so on. And, it's a big thing. And so they were a bit shocked by all this, and of course I had to provide a lot more data on what would be the consequences if we didn't get the money, you see. So we went through all the exercises, and we could take a couple of twin otters out of service and park them in Utah or somewhere, sort of dry area. We could do this, we could do that, all the sort of comic horror things that people don't like to hear, and so on and so forth. So, and that's what led to the Way Forward programme that you, Joanna's mentioned in her thing. They were prepared to give us some extra money, but they wanted to see us make economies, you see, in the operation, because essentially what we couldn't do was accept all this new infrastructure, which everybody wanted us to accept, but keep the old show running. See, so that's when we looked at what we could do in terms of savings, and it was at that point really we looked at the utility of Faraday.
When you say we, were you taking direction from David on this, or did David give you the job and tell you to get on with it? David Drury.
Well, yes. I mean, essentially, he was a great travelling man, as you know. Mm. I always seem to have directors who are constantly in other parts of the world. David knew full well what was going on, and we had long discussions about it and so forth when he was around. But I had to get on with the donkey work.
So the Way Forward was your baby?
In practical terms, yeah. But fully backed by David. I mean, David signed up to everything and led it, really, in the sense of explaining to the survey why we were having to do this, that and the other.
So did you see it as a slimming down or a rationalisation?
Oh, I think the latter, really. I mean, some staff would see it as slimming down, obviously, because losing Faraday was a big emotional blow. you know, but those directing the programme, like John Dudney and so on, were supportive of it, really. The Faraday at that time was not producing very much scientifically.
Tell me a bit about the thinking behind that then. Why was Faraday selected, and how did you deal with it? I know you transferred it to the Ukrainians. Mm. Tell me about that process.
Well, the reason Faraday was selected was twofold. One, that it absorbed running costs, obviously. It was a fairly large space. And by reducing it, we would save X amount per year. But the complication was that BAS, the UK, had signed up to the Environmental Protocol in 1991, I think it was, which was very much David's baby. I mean, he was very enthusiastic about that. But one of the consequences of that was that if you abandoned a base, you had to remove it. Mm. And when I'd done the calculations on that, that was going to be very expensive because it was a large space, a lot of concrete there. But the main problem in removing it was the ship time required. I mean, we couldn't manage it with our two vessels because we were so busy. So we'd have to charter shipping. So I think I came up with an estimate of, I don't know, $1.5 million to do it, you see, which we didn't have, of course. David said, well, why don't we just... It was his idea, actually. He said, why don't we just give it to another Antarctic country, you see? Hawk it round the circuit, Frank, he said. Which I did. We wrote to all the other Antarctic treaty nations saying, you're interested in acquiring this. And, of course... at that stage, the old Soviet Union had split up and Ukraine became a separate sovereign state. A lot of Ukrainian scientists had been involved in the Soviet programme. The ownership of the Russian bases or the Soviet bases in Antarctica fell legally to the Russian state and not to the Ukrainian state. So there was a core of scientists and logisticians who were out of a job, really, in the Ukraine. Yeah, that's right. They'd been shut out by, you know, the St. Petersburg headquarters and so forth. And so they expressed interest. And that was, you know, that was a long process, getting them to sign up. David and I and Mike Richardson from the Foreign Office went to the Ukraine initially and, you know, had a look at their setup, talked to the people. And a lot of vodka was. And I went back several times thereafter, and they came to us. And it was a very, very difficult process, really, the whole negotiation, because what we didn't understand was the internal politics in the Ukraine itself, which had, you know, they were in a difficult position financially and so on and so forth. But and they were very suspicious that you know, not the people involved in the Antarctic, but the politicians and the civil servants, very suspicious that you know, the UK was going to give them this base. And I remember, you know, I was called to give evidence to one of their parliamentary committees, you know, in their sort of Kremlin set up there or parliament. And I also remember everybody was looking terribly suspicious, and the chairman asked me through an interpreter, you know, why were we doing this? You know, why were we offering an island base? They were very suspicious that it was an island, you see. So, there was no magic behind it, really. But I had a moment of inspiration. I said, because we are an island people. And everybody burst out laughing. And we seemed to get past that hurdle. And then, of course, they came to us and we had the training and all the rest of it. And it was quite... And the other side of it, you know, Mike Richardson and I trail around their foreign ministry, because one of the things David insisted on, quite rightly, was that if they were going to take over the base, they had to sign the protocol. And it took a long time to get that across to them, you know.
There were strings attached, because there was ongoing recording science based at Faraday,
yes,
which had to be maintained by the Ukrainians.
Yes, I'm sure Jonathan's made those points to you, yes. And the scientists, our scientists, were very keen that those long-term data sets were maintained. And that was certainly one of the strings, yes. I have to say, the scientific side of of the Ukrainian setup was very good. You know, there was a good relationship built up, I think, between Jonathan and you know, the other ice and climate and scientists, and that was really good. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there an anecdote from your time in Ukraine?
Well, I've just given you one. I was trying to think, really. Not specifically. Okay. It was a very difficult time for the people in the Ukraine at the time. You know, you had to take brand new dollar bills and all this kind of thing, and there were, it was very difficult to operate there.
The other rationalisation was the transference of some of the biological work to Rothera, and that meant that Cygni would become
summer
only. And I was at the Cygni 60th dinner a few years ago, and people were still bitter and twisted about Cygni.
I know. I can understand that. Cygni was the other part of it, the Way Forward programme. I forget whose idea it was originally that we would make it summer only. I think it was probably David's again, actually. I was looking at the costs of Cygni and the difficulties and the modern... See, we wanted to modernise it, you see. That was part of the PES bid, you know, to modernise Cygni, because it was a dreadful plastic building there. And
Plastic Palace.
Yeah, the Plastic Palace you've probably heard all about, and the fueling facilities were a bit worrying too. Anyway, that was the decision. And again, I and my staff... had no experience of running summer-only bases, actually. So we went and saw the Italians. Did you know this?
Yeah.
No, okay. David and I and the head of the building section at the time, Al Smith.
Smith, big Al Smith.
Wonderful guy. And we knew the Italians operated at Terra Nova on a summer-only basis. They're based outside of Antarctica. And I don't know if you know much about the Italian programme, probably not. But their programme came about back in the 80s when Italy decided to become a non-nuclear nation. So they had a big sort of Harwell-type complex south of Rome, about 40 kilometres south of Rome. I forget the name of it now. And they put all this out to alternative technologies, a lot of engineers there. And they said, oh, we want to be in the Antarctic, you see. This is presumably a politician's idea, I'm not sure. So that what you had basically there, in addition to their sort of pure scientists, was a bunch of nuclear engineers who were very talented, I think. And they put a lot of money into it. The Italians were spending as much money as we were, funnily enough, for this one base. And they were very ingenious, and we were very impressed. I mean, while we were in their Rome outfit, south of Rome, you know, they were able to switch on the generators in. It was during the winter we went, UK, you know, northern winter. They were able to switch on generators and do scientific experiments down there completely remotely. They gave us a lot of good information about winterization and how to do it and so forth. They were very, very helpful, the Italians, I have to say. And when we asked them, you know, why are you doing summer only, they said it was purely cultural. They didn't want to be away from their families during the winter. And the other curious thing that they did, they took enormous quantities of bottled water down there, which is extremely heavy. Pretty unnecessarily, really. But again, that was a cultural thing, you see.
But again, you had the... In turning Cygni into a summer-only affair, there were some measurements that had to be carried out throughout the year. And there was a... I read about a chap called... And I've probably got the name wrong. Afanasyev?
Afanasyev, yes.
Afanasyev, who was... being very innovative under your guidance.
Oh, well, David, really. That was one of David's triumphs, actually.
Tell me about that.
Well, obviously, there was a lot of opposition to Cygni, internally, to Cygni becoming summer only. And one of the sort of crunch points was that they had these sea ice measurements that had gone back, you know, all the way back to 1948, I suppose, when Cygni was set up. You know, it's something we had to take very, very seriously. So David Blake sort of took on the job of looking at what could be done. And he and I forgot Afanasius' first name, Vladimir.
Yeah.
Vladimir. He was an interesting character in his own right. He'd got out of Russia during Brezhnev's time. But he was a very good engineer. And he and David came up with the idea of continuous daily photographs during the winter when the base was not manned to record the sea ice measurements. There's a hill at Cygne about 900 feet high where you could place a camera looking down on the bay to be able to carry out the measurements and, you know, some of the records. And David managed, I don't know whether it was David or Vladimir, came up with this. The only camera that could do the job was a 1938 Luftwaffe camera powered by lead acid batteries, that would take a daily photograph to the quality required by the scientists. And that was a bit of a... So, you know, we were able to sort of meet that particular obstacle, as it were.
So did this have a windscreen wiper to clear the snow off the lens? And
well, I should be able to answer that question because I was out at Cygne when I was on the last ship to clear out Cygne, which was the James Clark Ross, funnily enough. And we were there at the end of the season. And setting up the camera became the job of the radio officer at the time, technician, nice chap. And we all had to do jobs, you know, in my case with knocking down a shed, I think, or whatever. It was snowing at the time and we had no heat in the base and it was quite difficult. Anyway, he said, well, you can come and help me, Frank, get this bloody camera and the batteries up to the top of the hill. And the snow was very, very thick and I was carrying the batteries in the rucksack and he was carrying the camera. And the snow was there, and we struggled up this 900. Yeah, I always remember that to get it set up. So I should be able to tell you where the windscreen wipers. I'm pretty certain they weren't. I'm pretty certain they weren't actually. But David would be able to tell you.
Would it send the pictures back electronically by satellite, or did he have to go and empty the film at the end of the?
Yeah, I think it was the film at the end of it. Yeah.
Still,
yeah.
Quite remarkable.
Oh, it was a remarkable achievement by David and Vladimir. All credit to them, because they got round, you know, this demand in a very ingenious fashion.
So all that, the facilities, much of the facilities at Cygne were transferred to Rothera. So Rothera had to be developed.
Yeah.
And what was your, was that again was part of the way
that
forward?
That was part of the way forward. Was part of the bid.
Yeah.
That we would... You see, the logic of it was that because we were going to acquire the Dash 7, which is a story in its own right, we could get scientists in and out fairly quickly, and therefore it made sense to... And there was quite a lot of biological work that could be done there. Made sense to sort of transfer that, or at least part of that. I mean, Cygne still remained in the summer.
What's the Dash 7 story then? Was that... I think the commissioning of that was tricky because of the skis and wheels. Yeah.
Well,
memory?
My memory, you know, it was one of the projects that hadn't been implemented when I joined, you see. The contract had been placed to modify the aircraft, put in extra fuel tanks, generator at the back, what else? And the skis, the big pontoon skis, you see. So Paul Whiteman, who was the head of the aircraft section at the time, David, who was like me, David and I joined at the same time, we both ex-MOD, so we worked well together, really.
David?
Blake.
Blake, yes.
Yes, I forget what his title now, but he was head of technical services, as part of my sort of empire. But David and I were pretty close, you know, because we were ex-MOD, we understood each other quite well. Paul had been heavily involved in selection of the Dash 7, which I think was absolutely the right choice. I think they made the right choice of aeroplane. It was not a commercial success, as you know. The Dash 7 was a four-engined, it was originally designed as a 50-seater commuter aircraft. So de Havilland, it was not a success for de Havilland as far as was concerned, but London City in the 80s were operating them from London City Airport, And they bought this second hand and then placed a contract with Field Aviation in Toronto to modify it and put in the extra fuel tanks required and the other features and convert it to, you know, the BAS requirements. But what I hadn't done was actually, in MOD terms, work out a concept of operations. You know, they selected the right aircraft. It was robust. It would have the necessary range carrying and so on and so forth. But they hadn't worked out how they were going to use it, really. So I sat down with John Hall and that, and we looked at how we were going to operate this aircraft, you see, given the skis. And at that stage, the skis were at the design stage. And Field Aviation and the company that was doing the ski side of it, and I can't remember who they were, they were very evasive about payload. And we travelled to Toronto, I don't know, 4 or 5 times. And Paul was based there a lot of the time. And, you know, it became borne on us that the payload we were going to get at the end of the day, and John and I had envisaged, about 10 or 12 transits from the Falklands to Rotherham during the season. Those figures are not accurate, but, you know. And at the end of the day, we would be carrying about sort of 2 passengers and a couple of, you know, a couple of suitcases or something. Exaggeration, but the payload wasn't economic if we were going to put the pontoon skis on. So what the hell do we do, you know? So I flew over there for the last time with David to make sure we'd got the facts right. From Field and the other company, then had to go back and write a very, very quick paper for David, which had to go to the chief executive of NERC, of course, who was Sir John Nill, as he eventually became, actually saying, we don't think this is feasible. Embarrassing for the survey to have to say that, but you know, we had to do it, and so we abandoned. BAS retained ownership of the design, and it was an ambitious project. I mean, no other country, apart from the Americans with their ski-equipped Hercules that had been converted in the 1950s, no other country had you know, done such a project. I mean, the Twin Otters are very small aircraft, as you know. So that was embarrassing. But fortunately, the other thing I was dealing with when I joined was this National Audit Office thing, and they didn't pick up on that, fortunately.
Was that sleight of hand on your part?
No, not really.
Bottom of the agenda.
I think the timing wasn't quite right. It was still, I think by the time we'd sorted it all out, it was about a year after, possibly, the auditors had stopped. The auditors were almost starting when I joined, you see, on all these projects. And as you know, it went to the Public Accounts Committee.
Yeah.
And I had to go with Colin Reid, who was the finance director of NERC, and Sir John Nill, and, you know, sit behind them as you do in the PAC and
whisper in their ear.
Whisper in their ear, exactly, yes. And we didn't come out of it too badly, really.
But in the end, the Dash was able to fly economic flights to Rotherham because of the runway.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yeah. No, it was fine.
It just limited its use in the field, I guess.
Indeed, yeah. That was the other role envisaged, yes. Yeah, sorry, I hadn't explained that very well, yes. But again, a necessity is the mother of invention, really. And I forget, I think it might have been Paul or somebody in the survey or one of the pilots possibly came up with the idea of, you know, using these blue ice runways to extend the range, which is what we wanted, you know, to support the field programme. And again, tentatively, we looked at, you know, US experience in the Arctic and so on and so forth, and very tentatively we moved to that.
So you were involved in the establishment of Sky Blue?
Yes.
Down south, near Fossil... Is it near Fossil Bluff?
It's south of Fossil Bluff. Yeah. But what Sky Blue gave us was the ability to put fuel dumps there and extend the range of the Twin Otters. And that was something that... those ideas took a while to progress. We wanted to get the Dash 7 in the main role first.
Meanwhile, you had £4.4 million to spend at Rotherham.
Yeah.
So how was that?
How was that spent?
The thinking behind how it was spent. What were the conceptual decisions made?
Well, the first one we've already mentioned was the biological work. That was the main...
Was that the Bonner Lab?
That was the Bonner Lab, which, as you know, burnt down.
Yeah.
And the other was... the other side of it was the accommodation block, really, which, I mean, certainly when I first went down there, it had been self-built. And there were a lot of technical problems with it. You know, the glazing was such that, you know, the pressure within the building, you know, gave you a terrible sort of headache when you were sleeping. There was the plumbing was dreadful. And we lacked a sort of control tower complex and so forth. So that's largely what the money went into, really. And again, David and I broke new ground on that. But we said we wouldn't go in for self-build. We'd get a professional, you know, building outfit doing it. You see, we thought it would be great for British industry, you know, building industry.
This is Morrison's.
Yeah. Hmm. Now, I went to all the main companies, you know, memory's going now, but who were the big building contractors?
Wimpy, Langs,
Balfour Beatty, all those people. And they weren't interested.
Really?
Yeah, they weren't interested. And so eventually, I forget how we tracked down... no, it wasn't Morrison's. It was Morrison's came later.
They were more Halley-orientated, weren't they, I think,
yes,
as well. Yes,
it was a Birmingham firm... I don't know. You'd have to check the detail on that. I just can't remember their name.
Okay.
But they were a mid-sized British building company, and they decided, you know, they tendered and came up with both for the Signy summer only and for the Rotherham work. And that, you know, that worked quite well.
Did it go smoothly, or were you problem solving at several thousand miles?
Yeah, I mean, no projects of that size, building projects, ever go completely smoothly. There weren't any major. There were cultural problems with the builders and the base staff. That was an issue.
So how do you mean?
Well,
Friday night type things.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they what the builders didn't really understand, although we spent an enormous amount of time trying to indoctrinate them, that when you were down in Antarctica, you couldn't go around the corner and get some spare parts or, you know, bag of nails or what. You had to take everything with you, and you had to have the right clobber and so forth. There were a lot of issues like that, you know, which at the time seem very difficult, and they were, you know, the cultural impact of a load of builders with no real indoctrination about the Antarctic, mixing with, you know, our staff.
Graduate scientists, yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of problems like that. But in the end, the job got done. Probably David could give you a lot of chapter and verse about some of the work. I mean, some ways they were very, very concerned about permafrost and building on permafrost, but that didn't turn out to be a big issue in the end. You know, the quality of the cement and so forth, that sort of thing. I think the Bonner Lab was pretty good. You know, it was unfortunate there was an electrical fire later, but there we are. But the scientists were happy at the time.
Did you have any dealings with Greenpeace?
I didn't personally. The Greenpeace issue arose, as I remember it, in relation to the original gravel runway. Mm. And David Drury was very, very concerned about bad publicity from the Green Lobby. He was very much into, you know, the environment and so forth, quite rightly. And they took, on the maiden voyage of the James Clark Ross, on which I didn't go, by actually, Joe has that wrong there, David went. And he took with him a lady from, I'm not sure whether she was Greenpeace or World Wildlife Fund or whatever, but anyway, a prominent environmentalist. Down with her. The issue being the bird nesting and whether it was going to be disturbed by the runway and so forth. And I gather she was a bit of a pain in the neck on board and so forth. But Dave is probably the best person if you want detail on that. She had a sort of rather depressing name, and I can't remember.
Don't worry. In the midst of all this way forward, of course, David Drury left, didn't he?
Left in 90, you'd have the dates, 95, was it? Something like that. Most of it was completed by the time David left. I mean, all the spade work and most of the construction had been done and so forth, I think, by the time David had left. Do you have the date when it was?
Not. Barry Hayward writes the introduction to the 1994/5 annual report.
Oh, right. Well, maybe it was 94. Yes. Yes, probably.
Did that matter that he'd left?
This is where we get into people and so forth, isn't it? I regretted David's going enormously, and I think David Blake would tell you the same thing. He was quite an... People criticised David because he was a physical geographer and not a sort of pure physicist and so forth. But that's water off a duck's back as far as I'm concerned. I thought he was a good leader of the survey, very good with people, very forward-thinking. And the good thing about when David was in charge, on the whole, relations with NERC were fairly reasonable. John Nill was quite supportive of us on the whole. Of course, they'd had the rap over the knuckles and so on. So, and Eileen Buttle was the secretary at, it was the second post in NERC, the most senior post. And she was pretty supportive, and she and David got on well. So on the whole, I would say that they were the happy times as far as I was concerned. Dave is an ambitious guy, as you know from his CV, wanted to move on and so forth. But I was very, not upset, but I think we missed him. Mm-hmm. Missed his leadership. Not that I didn't get on very well with Barry Hayward. I don't mean this as a sort of criticism of Barry, who's a personal friend, really. But I think Barry was not really a number one person. He was very much a number two. And he saw his role very much as supporting David and, basically overseeing the science programme in the sort of detail that David didn't have time to do. So my relationship tended to be more with David than with Barry. There was no friction with Barry at all. But... Barry, because he was old survey, if you like, carried a lot of prejudice. Perhaps prejudice is the wrong word to use. Yeah, with the NERC relationship and so forth. Because he'd been through a lot, the way NERC had treated Baz in the earlier days. And so he was very suspicious of NERC, and of course that didn't help relationships. And John Nill left as well, and John Krebs took over. And he was, his interview on the BBC actually only a few months ago, because he'd been, they reviewed his life really, and he was very much of a colder personality, should I say, and he seemed to pick up on the residual... what I call sort of palace guard type of thinking at NERC, which was, Baz was paddling its own canoe and ought to be under some control, and maybe they're doing the science that we don't think should, is all that important and all that stuff. I'm sure you've had a basin full of that in your previous interviews. And he didn't like the interference from the Foreign Office, and started a bit of a confrontation with the Foreign Office, which you're never going to win. As you probably know from your BBC days. And so all those politics that I had hitherto not been quite as exposed to came into sharp relief. And David, when he was at NERC, I don't think fitted in all that well with their corporate culture, and his eyes were elsewhere, you know, when he was deputy chief executive. I did try him on occasion, persuade him to sort of come back, but when Barry had broken his leg and so forth. And I think, when was it? He then went to the British Council and then had some difficult times there. And I did inquire as to whether he would come back to Bowes. But that wasn't on the cards. But there we are.
I sense a dinner gong about to be struck, so let's break.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.